Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first episode of our very brand new podcast that we thought of today.
It's really, really brand new.
It's called Raging Bullshit, and we are going to talk about movies, try to come up with some kind of thesis or interesting thing to talk about, and hopefully you'll enjoy the two of us talking about whatever we're talking about, because this is what we do when we hang out, and so we thought we would just record it.
We hope it's as entertaining for you as it is for us.
So what we're talking about today is the idea of having a blank slate character in a movie, and how that can really open up a film, or I mean even a novel or a video game, and to make the experience more for you and less about the filmmakers or the story. And it just allows you to experience the narrative in a different way. And we thought that was kind of a cool thing to talk about for a little while. So that's what we're going to do. The first movie, the thing that brought this movie on is actually, this is all Jesse's idea. We were talking about The Matrix earlier today and kind of what a neat movie that was in 1999. And we were kind of talking about some of the outdated visuals, but the core of the movie is still holds up so well after almost 20 years now. I'll let Jesse talk a little bit about what he told me about how the sort of Neo is a blank slate for the viewer to kind of project whatever.
We'll see if I can remember what I was even saying. For me, it always felt like a more personalized experience watching that movie, because I would say in the beginning of The Matrix, Neo is almost not even there. Like, he has so very little discernible traits, other than you can see he clearly works a worker drone kind of job. He lives in a really crappy little dingy apartment. He seems to consort with weird cloaked looking underground kind of guys. I don't even know what kind of dudes those were, but they all hang out at BDSM clubs. I don't know what kind of circle that is, but whatever.
Also, like, the main guy who comes to his house that like buys the thing from him, like, just
Troy or whatever.
By today's standards, like, he looks like an office nerd dressed up in some he looks completely harmless by today's standards.
If we could flesh out I think the dude's name in the movie was Troy. If we could flesh Troy out, I'm pretty sure that's just his extracurricular activities after work. He hangs out with people.
He could have even been on the job.
Maybe they know each other from work.
Okay, so here's an interesting fact. I'm on IMDb. All credit, this is not from me, but from IMDb. Mm-hmm. The trivia says that in the first 45 minutes of The Matrix, Neo has 80 lines.
I believe it.
44 of these lines are questions.
Well, that's most of Neo's lines.
And then it averages one question per minute.
Oh, okay.
I think 80 lines, sounds pretty low to me.
Yeah, that's pretty sparse.
Yeah, for the first 40 minutes, and that's pretty hilarious that half of them are questions. I mean, that really goes towards this argument of the blank slate character.
That's what I would say. For me, it felt like there's so much room in between lines that I remember when I watched it when I was younger, is me and Neo are asking some of the same questions.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And I think that's going to be different for every single person, because I watched it with a friend who hated The Matrix.
Oh. Huh.
And just was like, yeah, I don't give a shit. He liked Cypher.
What? I mean.
But that's besides the point. For me, it felt like you're watching The Matrix, Neo's asking a lot of the same questions that you're asking, and that space in between lines gives you time to sort of ponder.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of movies these days is you're just sort of barreling through a plot.
Right.
At like breakneck speeds, and games too.
Yeah.
That you don't get a lot of time to really appreciate the world that's being built around you.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because The Matrix, this is another thing that we were talking about earlier today, was that the setting of the movie is, I mean, there was lots of settings like that mm-hmm. in the late 90s, right? Like Dark City is very similar yeah. to The Matrix. Yeah. Like, you know, a city that's like kind of always raining and
yeah,
I don't know, just a little bit artificial mm-hmm. feeling. And the movie Seven kind of has a similar,
oh yeah, yeah,
you know, kind of,
even their daytime scenes are pretty like,
right, yeah,
whatever,
oppressive
kind of, yeah.
So I think like the really like, you know, the Matrix part of the Matrix isn't really new or it was mm-hmm. you know, but it really was like those questions that Neo was asking. And yeah, I guess sort of his journey inside of the first 40 minutes of that, whatever the yeah. until he gets out of the Matrix. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that hero's journey.
Yeah.
It's
yeah. Really, yeah. Really, really similar.
Yeah.
I guess it kind of is the hero's journey.
Yeah.
Just like a big twist on it. I mean, but like really like the screenwriting though, in terms of how we're fed that information is mm-hmm. just, through questions rather than just,
yeah, through endless
constant exposition or something.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so cool. I'm trying to think of a specific part in the movie where here's kind of an interesting one is that we are introduced to the agents like right in the beginning of the movie, but we are given no information about mm-hmm. them at all.
Yeah, other than the look, you know, being sort of the standard like FBI mm-hmm. Agent sort of mm-hmm. attire,
right,
and demeanor. And obviously we see him talking to the police
mm-hmm.
lieutenant or whatever.
He says like, your men are already dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we see in a few scenes later, we see the agent, I guess they, oh, that's right. Because Neo doesn't want to go on the scaffold
yeah.
to get off the roof. And so they capture him.
He surrenders.
And like, we still kind of don't know what the agents are or anything, but then they mm-hmm. put that weird bug thing.
Yeah.
And he has some lines with Hugo Weaving, Keanu mm-hmm. Reeves and Hugo Weaving have some lines, but we don't really know what is going on
yeah.
at all at that point in the movie, which is so strange because, you know, you and I both saw this movie when we were like in the third or the fourth grade
yep.
as young, very young kids, probably not even, we probably shouldn't have been watching
yeah,
this movie.
Yeah, exactly. There was
but
some...
like, I don't even remember at that age being confused though.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember thinking like these agents are some like bad dudes or whatever. Like they're
yeah.
like obviously the antagonists of this movie, but like mm-hmm. I didn't really care about like, oh, they just shoved this bug down Neo's belly button, you
yeah.
know, like I need exposition on it immediately. It's like, I think it's kind of cool how they just sort of hold that information from you and they're just like scarier that way almost. It's mm-hmm. like this enemy that you don't understand. It's really mm-hmm. cool. And like, I think even in that scene, Neo asks some very, he asks a lot of questions like,
yeah.
And then, but then he's like, you know, then his mouth closes up or whatever. That part's kind of cool.
Well, I think that's what starts to introduce us to, it always felt to me like there was this weird split in Neo's personality.
Oh.
And I think you see this at a few key moments in all three of the films.
Hmm.
In the scene where they're in the interview room and it's just Neo and the agents, mm-hmm. he's talking to Agent Smith. Agent Smith says, we've had our eye on you for some time
yeah.
now. And Neo's response is...
Good Hugo Weaving voice, by the way. Yeah.
I think Neo's response is, well, why don't I give you the finger
yeah,
and you
yeah.
give me my phone call?
Yeah.
You see this real glimmer of Neo's personality
ah,
for the first time
yes.
as being willfully defiant.
Right.
And just like, I know what I'm doing. I know what my rights are.
Right.
And I choose not to be intimidated by this. But at the same time, you know, moments later, you know, it's like, well, what good is a phone call if you can't speak? His mouth disappears.
Yeah.
And obviously Neo does not know what he's doing. He has no idea what he's up against. And
so not that I want to talk about the other Matrix movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm actually just curious at this point, what are in the second and third movie?
I would say when he goes in to... he meets the architect in
oh, okay.
In Reloaded. There's
yeah,
all
yeah,
the
yeah,
monitors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's definitely a bit more,
a little
defiant
pissier
in that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I almost wonder, like, I mean, who knows? It's like the worst question in the world to ask. Yeah. What were the writers thinking when they wrote this?
Yeah.
That's just like a stupid question. That's like, whatever. But you almost, you can't help but wonder, like, is this an intentional thing or not? Because it is really interesting. Now, both of those movies have the same sort of thing where, like, there are parts of the movie that you do see this flash of rebellion, this sort of, this Neo embodies his cause, like his
I like that you bring that up, because they kind of touch on that, and I'm sorry to keep us talking about Reloaded, but they kind of touch on that. The architect says you are like the eventuality of an unchecked remainder in this program, so sort of like who you are was sort of predestined, and you needed these qualities, like everyone that came, every specific person who was the one that came before Neo had supposedly had these same qualities, but Neo experienced them, the way the architect puts it, in a far more profound way, vis-a-vis love, quote it directly. So that's Neo and Trinity.
Right.
But they sort of, they allude to that. The one has this sort of, to quote Morpheus from Reloaded, an affinity for disobedience.
You know, and that's funny that in that scene, there are parts where Neo is all in the monitors, like flicking off the architect and doing all this stuff, right?
It's
like
his, yelling, like, and his cursing at
whatever is in his mind, I guess, is what's shown on the TV. That's a weird, that's a very weird scene in that movie. Like,
I think it's supposed to just represent all of the possible reactions that he could have.
Gotcha.
And then they zoom in on just,
this whole thing is now starting to remind me of like a build your own character in an RPG for some reason. Yeah. I mean, Neo really is a perfectly moldable type of way to experience the Matrix lore. Almost like, anyway, we're gonna move on from the Matrix for a moment, and we're gonna introduce kind of our second movie that we wanted to talk about, and this is these movies are not related anyway. The second movie where the main character is sort of this blank slate type of character is Mad Max Fury Road, which came out just a few years ago. If you haven't seen it, it's great. I didn't give a spoiler warning for The Matrix because everybody listening has probably seen that already.
Yeah, you probably don't.
But, like, you know, if you haven't seen Mad Max, you should stop listening now and go watch that movie first, because it's amazing.
And if you haven't seen The Matrix, I'm sorry, I just totally ruined The Matrix for you, too.
No, you didn't spoil the third one. I don't even remember what happened in the third Matrix, honestly. But
in the third Matrix, that's where spoiler Smith alert. Becomes Jesus, and the whole world turns into a black hole.
Oh, gotcha. So. It's actually, the whole world is actually Agent Smith's anus.
Pretty much.
Sorry, bad joke. Anyway, moving on to Mad Max. It's a wonderful movie.
Yep.
But we do have, and I mean, this probably applies to the old Mad Max movies too, but just since Fury Road is like so on our minds or whatever. Fury Road, who plays Mad Max again? It's Tom Hardy.
Yeah, Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy. And he is, I mean, I wonder if I could pull up, well, you know, I'll have you talk in a second. I'll pull up maybe the IMDb for that. Maybe there's some interesting lines about that. How many like lines Tom Hardy actually has. It's probably very little, though.
And that's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
I would start by comparing the actors, Tom Hardy to, I'm drawing a blank.
Keanu Reeves.
Keanu Reeves, yeah. Keanu Reeves, just like you said about Neo being very moldable, I would say Keanu Reeves as an actor is very moldable. If you sort of watch his early career on to now, I'd say as a director, he's like a lump of clay. He's very easy to, you know, be an action star, be fairly dramatic. You could put him into sort of romantic comedy, and he could be kind of goofy and awkward.
Oh, that's a really
stiff,
really good point. Yeah, he can. Keanu Reeves, say what you want about his acting chops or whatever, but like he's versatile in a weird way. Any genre.
Yeah.
Like, and he could play, almost, he could play a great bad guy or a good guy. Like, He was in My Own Private Idaho.
Oh, yeah.
With,
yeah.
Gus Van Sant's, like, 97 underrated gym.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was in Point Break shortly before that, I believe.
Yep.
I mean, yeah, that's so true. I mean, he's extremely, he was in The Devil's Advocate.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed him in The Devil's Advocate. Yeah. That was good.
So are you trying to say that Tom Hardy is similar?
No, I would say very different.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I'd say Tom Hardy is much more gregarious, much more...
I don't know what that word means. You're going to have to define it for me.
He's much more versatile in his acting ability. He's got a much... It's hard really to compare, but I'd say his filmography and his background is a lot more eclectic than Keanu Reeves.
Okay. I'm a new tab. I'm pulling up Tom Hardy's IMDb. I'm not as familiar with Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
If
I remember right, he got his start in Hollywood in like Star Trek Nemesis.
What's that?
A really bad Star Trek movie.
I don't even think I've seen it.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom Hardy said that it drove him towards alcoholism.
Oh, shit.
And addiction.
Let's see. Okay. Oh, apparently there's going to be a new Mad Max.
Ooh.
Sweet. 2000. No, it doesn't even say. Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about, so you're saying out of the two of them, Tom Hardy is more...
He's more of an actor.
Yeah, he's more of an actor. Okay, that's...
To put it simply.
Put it simply, yeah. I that's hard. I don't know. I'm looking at his IMDb right now. I don't really... So there's not really a whole lot of evidence to back this up based off of the movies he's been in.
Yeah.
But I do kind of agree with you. Like, let's take a movie like he was in Inception. I didn't really think his character in Inception was like anything to...
Yeah, he was a really minor character.
Super memorable, yeah.
There's one... let me see if I can find this here, on IMDb.
We can compare two movies quickly to kind of show the difference. He was in The Dark Knight Rises as Bane. And he was also just a few years later, he was in The Revenant.
Yeah.
And in The Revenant, I guess he plays the bad guy in... Oh, sorry. Spoilers for The Revenant.
Yep.
Damn, I really got to watch those.
Tom Hardy's a bad guy.
He's real bad in The Revenant.
Actually,
but I think you kind of get that from the beginning. He's kind of an asshole the whole time.
I was going to ask you if you'd seen the movie Legend.
No, I've never seen Legend.
Legend, Tom Hardy plays two characters. They're twin brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And one is like a total, I guess you'd call him a psychopath.
Uh-huh.
And the other is just sort of a wise ass sort of criminal guy, sort of like a British mobster, you know, dresses in nice suits, runs sort of a racketeering kind of a thing.
So
but
in
his
that
brother is completely crazy and out of control.
So even within the same movie, he's having to play like
two
really
very
different
characters. But still, they have similarities, but they're still very
different. Yeah, see, I can't even imagine Keanu Reeves doing something like that.
Yeah, at one point, Tom Hardy is fighting Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
And then just beating the crap out of Tom Hardy.
Oh, wow.
It's a great movie.
Oh, wow. Okay, so let's go back. Let's tie this back into Mad Max a little bit. Like, how... Do you think that did that help or hurt, like, the Mad Max character? Or do you think that did it do anything different for that movie versus Neo versus Mad Max?
Yeah.
How did those actors fit into those parts?
Well, I'd say for Mad Max, he did a lot more of facial acting and a lot more intonation.
Oh, that's interesting.
Where Neo definitely, he's driving it being a blank slate, as in, like, every new experience is brand new. What is this? What is that? What does this mean?
Oh,
whereas
right.
Mad Max definitely, you get the sense that he knows the world he's
right,
in.
Right, right. Yeah, he seems like...
He's hardened.
And he's an expert. Like,
yeah.
Like, he's an expert survivor.
Yep.
Yeah, you definitely do get that. I never really thought about that. But yeah, he is a blank slate. Because he doesn't talk in the movie.
Yeah.
He has like 10 lines maybe.
Yeah.
Nah, probably more than that. But anyway, well, versus like we said Neo had like 80 lines.
At least.
I would think definitely Mad Max has Tom Hardy has fewer lines in Fury Road than Neo. But very similar in
sort of how it challenges the viewer to, because you have to take a lot of leaps, I feel like, mm-hmm. with both characters.
Right.
To say, you know, what's driving them to make their decisions?
You know, and I almost think that The Matrix handled that better than Mad Max did.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if there is one problem with Fury Road, I mean, I think I would give the movie a 10 out of 10. I think it's a perfect movie.
Yeah.
If I had like the very subtle critique of it is that sometimes it's just very unclear why Mad Max is like choosing the stuff that he does.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's
kind
of like you kind of seem like at first he's like a guy who really doesn't give a shit about mm-hmm. what happens to the people around him or whatever. But then it's like, is he doing it for his own motives, or is he like, does he actually care about Furiosa?
Yeah.
Or it's like by the end of the movie, you can tell that he saves Furiosa at the end.
Yeah.
So like,
and that's what the first time I watched it, I could see potential for a connection between him and Furiosa.
Uh-huh.
But they just kept faking you out and faking you out.
Yeah, yeah.
They just kept showing you like he would sort of help her out when it was convenient and necessary.
Right.
But you never got the sense that he implicitly cared.
Right.
Yeah. And that just kept confusing me about his personal motivations.
Right. And like, I think in the sort of like argument that we're going for with the sort of blank slate character, that's where it becomes a little muddy, in my opinion. I feel like in the Neo scenario,
at least with the first Matrix.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We won't.
I feel like they, in the last two, they sort of shot that idea in the head and watched it die a slow, painful death.
Yeah. I think you're spot on there. Yeah. But yeah, in terms of just the Matrix, the first one, it's the blank slate way of storytelling through Neo, kind of how we as viewers project ourselves onto the Neo character is mm-hmm. so seamless.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, and some of that could be due to the fact that you and I both saw it when we were kids.
Yeah.
I guess it was like, it might be easier for our brains to have kind of done that.
Yeah.
Versus being however we were both around. I was around 27, 26 when Fury Road came out, but
and I was at least 23.
Yeah. So I mean, we were both in our 20s. Yeah. So, but then again, we both watched The Matrix recently, and it held up pretty well.
Yeah, and I still feel, you know, when I watch it again, I try to watch it, you know, every like maybe 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I still can sort of feel that magic of.
Mm-hmm.
I remember back to not knowing where all this goes.
Right.
And that blank feeling of, oh, I can see why he'd be confused here or freaked out here.
Do you think that the reason The Matrix does it so well is because it asks more questions than it answers? Like, I mean, I think that kind of goes such a long way for that genre, the sci-fi genre mm-hmm. of just, what if, what is this?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of a going beyond the realm, that's going beyond the scope of our argument, but like, it's still kind of an interesting thing to think about is like,
well, it's a big component of mm-hmm. it. Is that why this works so well?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, I don't know if I can adequately answer that, but I feel like the characters themselves, they show this almost like, you know, there's like a Holocaust moment in their history where they know at, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, there was AI, there was a war with machines. We blacked out the sky, but they don't really have a firm grasp of where they are in time.
Mm.
Morpheus says we could be closer to the year 2199 than 1999.
Yeah.
And if you watch real carefully, there's a plaque on the ship that says Nebuchadnezzar,
uh-huh.
commissioned by the United States Army or something in the year 2059 or something.
Huh.
So you get this vague
idea
for the timeline. But I feel like the characters themselves don't really fully know the world.
Right. That's really, really... So Mad Max is actually pretty much the opposite.
Yeah.
Like, we Mad Max, or really any of the characters in Mad Max, they don't ask any questions.
Yeah,
they just expect the viewer to be thrown into the middle of the movie. Yeah. And I mean, I guess there is some difference here because we're dealing with the third, I believe it's Fury Road is the third Mad Max movie, because there's,
I think so, yeah,
the Thunderdome.
Oh, right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
And then there's the first one.
Yeah.
I think there, it's either the third or the fourth Mad Max. I can't even keep them straight anymore, but there is a lot of, I guess, continuity already in place.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, feel like Mad Max Fury Road really was a standalone thing.
Right. Well, I mean, but the Mad Max character is still the same guy.
Yep.
So, like, I don't know. But at the same time, I know the movie was meant to pull in new fans as well, too. So I don't think you're supposed to really know. You don't need to know a whole lot going into it.
Yeah, like, it can stand on its own, as you could almost look at it as an entry into but it's also following, like you said, that continuity.
Right. And I think, too, like, the lack of questions or answers in Fury Road is kind of, it's almost like taking it one step further, where it's like, bitch, you don't even need questions. Like, we're not going to give you any answers. We don't care. We're just going to show you a guy playing a guitar on top, you know, with flames shooting out of his guitar.
Yeah.
With, you know, the guy has, like, no nose.
Yeah.
And, like, what the hell?
It's just so over the top badass that, like, why you don't want an answer to that question. The question is the answer. it is what it is.
Why? Smack. Shut up. You don't need to know why. It's for aesthetics.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's actually really cool that in Mad Max, we never stop really as viewers we're almost not even given time to ask questions. We're just like, you know, we're kind of thrown right into the middle of the war boys, you know, kind of like, oh man, these war boy, they all live just for the glory of
it's
being
like,
able to kill or whatever. And like, just kind of being thrown into the middle of that, whatever kind of, hierarchy.
I always felt like it was like a mix between meth heads and Klingons.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Like, there's definitely, like, a tribal
thing
going on here. And, like, definitely they got, like, a chieftain kind of a figure leading their society. And he's definitely got, like, I don't know if she was his wife or, like a queen kind of a thing. I don't know. But there's definitely, like,
she has a lot of babies.
His main squeeze, whatever.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's definitely some kind of society that you get introduced to.
A very weird one.
A very weird society.
It's some kind of like lactation fetish.
Yeah.
Going on there too. Maybe
I'm not quite sure if
George Miller is into that or something.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of boob milk.
Well, a big fixation on lactation.
In Mad Max.
Yeah.
You know, and actually that would be like a whole nother essay, I think, is like the fixation on like, this is not an original idea, but I've kind of seen this in other places, how Mad Max has a lot to do with bodily fluids. I don't know where I saw that, but it's all over. Anyway.
That's interesting. It's really gross, but that's really
another episode. Or if I can think of who said that, I'll link it or something. But
yeah, we should explore that.
Yeah. But Charlize Theron in Mad Max is not a blank slate. She's extremely full of character. She's almost like the opposite of Max.
Yeah, like
does Neo have? Would you say like Morpheus is?
No.
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 He doesn't really. Yeah, I guess not.
I mean, like Morpheus. At first, you get the feeling like, oh, this guy's savvy. He knows what's up.
Yeah.
But then, the more and more you go, Morpheus really gets outmoded by Neo really fast.
You know, Morpheus is the Piccolo to, if Neo was Goku, Piccolo would be Morpheus, right? That's like the same relationship there, where it's like at first it's sort of a mentor relationship kind of, or whatever.
Well, I mean, Piccolo starts off as being
a bad, he's
their adversary,
but there's respect, right? There's like a whole lot of respect there, but then like at some point Goku becomes like way more powerful than Piccolo.
Like it was neck and neck, like who was more powerful, and then Goku starts surpassing him. And Piccolo has, he sort of gets this begrudging respect after a long time.
Right. Okay. So maybe it's not anything the same.
It's pretty different. Yeah. But
sorry.
I could feel what you're talking about.
Listeners,
there.
Anyway, we'll move on.
We probably got some Dragon Ball Z fans. Are like, no.
Yeah,
no.
They're just like turning this podcast off. It sucks.
Our apologies.
Anyway, Charlize Theron. You don't think she has sort of a similar, like, there's not a similar kind of dichotomy in the Matrix, you don't think? I think there kind of is. I mean,
well, maybe between Smith and Neo, because you got to admit Smith has,
yeah, that's true,
he
know, like, he's the all-knowing, yeah. All, yeah,
and that's like what he's going for,
yeah,
is he eventually wants to be, he wants to be the Matrix, he wants to be it,
right?
And not so, just, he just wants to be God, really, at the end of it all.
Gotcha. If the Matrix did have a character like Furiosa, that would be super interesting, though. Yeah. Like, so one thing I love about Mad Max is that you have the main character, Max, mm-hmm. but you also have another main character in,
yeah,
another protagonist to root for, yeah, that feels like the main character. Like,
I almost felt like they said, take your pick, which one do you like better?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I really like that a lot, because yeah, we're given the blank slate in Max to kind of view all of these events through, but then yeah, we're also given the Furiosa, like, person to root for, I mm-hmm. guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really cool. But yeah, so I guess the Matrix doesn't really have anything like that, but,
well, unless you want to root for Smith, which, yeah, sometimes I do.
Do you?
Secretly.
Yeah.
Like the scene where he talks about human beings are disease.
Oh, God, that's a good one.
Yeah, you're like, oh, he kind of has a point. I don't
yeah.
know.
And he's like, the only other organism, a virus.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, shit.
It's like, oh, this guy's talking a lot of sense. I don't know, you guys.
Yeah. No,
but then
for real.
He turns into a virus himself, and it's all goes
so
all down the tubes.
We're going to explore one more movie in our little essay, whatever you want to call this. The last movie we wanted to bring up, where we feel like this method of storytelling is really, like, apparent, mm-hmm. is a Disney movie. WALL-E came out in, I want to say, 2008.
Yeah.
I can look this up really quick. But WALL-E has no speaking lines, I believe.
Yep.
Because the robot can't talk.
I think he says, like, WALL-E. I think he says that.
He says WALL-E.
Kind of like an R2-D2 kind of character.
Right. Which we could, I mean,
you could make the same kind of argument for R2-D2. Almost.
You could. But R2-D2 is not the main
yeah.
character of the, yeah. But so WALL-E is, it did. It came out in 2008. It has an 8.4 on IMDb, in case if anyone was interested. Yeah. It won an Oscar. There is no dialogue with WALL-E, but we don't really need it, because the other elements of the storytelling in WALL-E are so high quality
yeah.
that you don't need dialogue.
And I would say this isn't the first time Disney's done that, too. Characters like Stitch and Lilo and Stitch. I think Stitch has more lines, but he doesn't really speak English.
Mm-hmm. That's a really, really good point. So, yeah, Disney has kind of already explored
yeah.
this construct a little bit before. Yeah, Lilo and Stitch is a great example of that.
Yeah.
I can't really talk about that movie very much. It's been years and years since I've watched it.
Yeah, same here.
I mean, probably, yeah, since the early 2000s. But
I just remember that much about it.
Wow. WALL-E was nominated for 6 Academy Awards. What about WALL-E makes it so good? I mean, it's hard. It's sort of, because this movie came out at around the same time we had Ratatouille, which is another phenomenal Disney movie.
Yeah.
Up came out in a similar time
yeah.
frame. Both of those movies are so the opposite of WALL-E,
yeah.
right? Like, I mean, those movies are in your, like, the characters are so vibrant.
Lots of, so much character to
yeah,
the character.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that WALL-E it doesn't have,
yeah,
WALL-E
yeah,
has
yeah.
great facial expressions, great, I mean, like,
yeah.
WALL-E definitely is an amazing character, but it sort of is a blank slate for us to view the, sort of the post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, and I think that's what I imagine they were going for with them. because there's a vulnerability to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what people respond to, is the vulnerability. And in a weird kind of way, all three characters have the same vulnerability.
Hmm.
Where when they're not sort of imposing their character on the story, on the audience,
mm-hmm.
they're not really overstating their motivation.
Yeah, it's not like none of them are opinionated.
Yeah, they're not very, exactly, yeah. not very opinionated.
Right.
And that, it's almost like a trick, I think, uh-huh. where you can, like, it's like the same way you see animals as being really cute because they can't go, I'm pissed.
Yeah.
I have to go take a shit outside.
My dog says that.
Well, your dog's pretty special.
Our dog's right here. The cutest.
Yeah, she's over here laying in the sun.
Yeah.
But anyways, I was thinking, I don't know if that's just like a byproduct of it, but for me, that sort of vulnerability, it's almost like anthropomorphism with animals, where you project your own personal qualities onto it, and that sort of bridges the gap in relatability. Where, especially with Wally, he gives cute little noises and expressions, and that, you know, cues you to react, and that indicates what he's thinking about and doing, but he can't at all say it in any certain terms. So there's
the psychology of it is definitely interesting. Like, I wonder. I mean, obviously, we've talked about nothing but movies that have come out within the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, we don't really have a good example for you guys listening that's before that. Because I'm sure, obviously, like, this mechanism of storytelling has probably been around forever.
For ages, yeah.
But it is really interesting nonetheless. And I would argue that these movies are so much better off for it. Not only because it's unique. Like, it's a unique way for the viewer to experience a story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also powerful because it's not like, it's like almost like you're definitely in the case of like Wally and Mad Max, it almost is like you're like being told the story like in the second person.
Yeah.
And that's a really kind of a unique way to approach that. And so, I mean, yeah, so I think we would both argue that, like, it's definitely, it should be done more, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I feel like there are many movies that would benefit from less shoving all of these ideas and rapid-paced plot into your face, you know, via exposition, you know, like.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, like, a lot of stories, a lot of films these days would definitely benefit from like taking a step back and like thinking like, you know, instead of chalking like our main character up full of characterization, maybe taking a little bit of it away is sometimes a good thing.
Yeah, I think just in the aspect of having like a vessel,
because
that's kind of how I look at it too, is it's almost like they're like a platform to carry you through the story instead of, you know, like all the other characters surrounding them can be very well filled out, but they kind of need to serve as sort of an empty vessel to carry you through the story.
Right.
And I think, especially nowadays, we got movies with so much exposition where like they get a monitor and they, like sci-fi movies like Interstellar, we got this going on and this going to happen this time. And before you even really get into the meat of the story, you already really know everything technically going on.
I have to go on the record and say, and if my girlfriend ever listens to this, she's gonna appreciate this, the Interstellar has got to be one of my least favorite movies. Just I don't even know why. Like, I have no reason to dislike it. I mean, some of the things that you just mentioned, but like, we watched it the night before I moved, remember?
Oh yeah,
we did. And we watched it like midnight, like several years ago.
On my dad's new TV.
Yeah, and I just hated it. Like, I couldn't stop watching it.
I didn't know that. You were into it the whole time.
You know, it's like I couldn't stop watching it because it was like visually very interesting. But
yeah,
like,
it was.
I just like, I think it's just like kind of going against everything we've talked about in this episode.
And it was even worse from, you know, because Christopher Nolan had done some really great movies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Inception, I'm not saying I don't actually think Interstellar is a bad movie. Yeah. I think it's just like, it's not even overrated because there's so many people who don't like it.
Yeah.
But it's just, I think it's like, it doesn't get enough hate or something. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. There's something about it that's just so irritating.
Well, it's like they willfully flew in the face of every cool thing Christopher Nolan had established prior to Interstellar.
Maybe that's it. I don't know. Yeah.
And maybe he's aware of that. Maybe he did it on purpose.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe. It looks like a very fun movie to make.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's the blank slate. What was it called? Tabula Rasa is like the more what language is that? I don't even know what language is that. Is that the Latin?
That sounds Latin to me. Yeah. Let me look that up. So we can.
So there is like a, you know, more intellectual phrase that's used commonly to what we're calling is like sort of the blank slate.
I think it literally just.
I think, like, that's verbatim, just a translation.
Blank and slate.
But this is not only limited to film. There's one of my favorite novels of all time is Italo Calvino's novel, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler. Strongly recommend. It's a fabulous book.
I should check that out.
Yeah, I mean, you the reader are a character in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So literally there you are. Yeah. It's you are like the main character.
Like a classy choose your own adventure kind of a thing.
Sort of. Yeah, it sounds really dumb when I'm talking about it.
No, it sounds great to me. That sounds good.
It's excellent, but it really has a lot of these same principles that we're talking about where you can just sort of you can kind of project yourself into the story, like and it's such a different experience than most other novels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure the blank slate mechanism of storytelling is definitely in other novels too that I just like can't think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, yeah, I mean, that's kind of a very literal example that I can think of. And then obviously you and I were also talking about earlier that video games are really some of the best games that we've ever played.
Yeah, certainly some of my favorites.
Yeah, the best example that Jesse and I came up with earlier was The Legend of Zelda.
Yeah.
Is really completely. I mean, Link doesn't talk.
And I really love that they kept that because it makes sense. The original Legend of Zelda came out on the NES in the 80s. You couldn't technically create a voice for him. But I love that they didn't, you know, with like Ocarina of Time on the N64 go, well, now we have the capability. Let's start adding in, you know, dialogue for Link.
Right.
And the Wind Waker on the GameCube. They have a little bit of, you know, sounds here and there, but I'm happy that they didn't decide to keep fleshing Link out more and more, that they kept him as just Link.
Yeah, so in the, like, I mean, The Legend of Zelda, all of them. I mean, the ones I'm most familiar with are like Wind Waker, Twilight Princess, Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are amazing games, but like then you look at something like The Witcher 3.
Yeah.
Where you have Geralt, is his name? The main character.
I think so.
Who is exactly the opposite. He's like, you know, full of character, full of life.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's definitely not like the absence of a like any kind of dialogue or something for Link doesn't necessarily translate into making it a good game. It's just.
Yeah, like that's not the reason for it.
Right, right. It's just like that is certainly. It certainly, in my mind, helps. Like, I love that about Link, that it's sort of just you, the player, playing this. Like, and I think that's what RPGs are kind of all about.
Well, I would make the same argument. I was talking to you a lot about Jack and Daxter.
Oh.
And I know you haven't played that, but you've played Crash Bandicoot.
I've played Crash. Yeah, there's another. Yeah.
And I would say that one thing, I don't know if anybody in the world can relate to this, but one thing I did as a kid playing these games is I would invent little stories in my head as I'm playing them.
Oh.
To kind of add more detail to the game myself. Like, why is Crash doing this? Why is he... Or, you know, to kind of imagine more of a character for him.
That's
and I
really
think in a weird kind of way, that made him more of like an extension of me.
Yeah.
And it makes it a very personal experience.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you bring that up, because I didn't really think of scenarios for Crash Bandicoot or anything. Mm-hmm. I think you were probably like smarter as a kid than I was.
I don't know.
Maybe
about
more
that.
More imaginative or something.
I was my teachers were worried about me when I was I'll only talk about this for a brief moment, but I had a first grade teacher suggest to my mom. I had written a story about a space alien.
Uh-huh.
But the teachers said it was too detailed and too realistic.
What?
And that maybe she should consider getting me some professional help.
Oh, man.
I think I turned out all right. But
I think you did.
Thank
you. I think you did. I think trying to, take down somebody's creativity like that is that's awful. But anyway, Crash Bandicoot. I never really did that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have a very similar reaction to Crash, where I did like that, where I didn't really know much about the Crash Bandicoot world. It doesn't really it doesn't really have much lore.
There's like, if
it's some,
did you play the first one?
I don't really remember it too. I remember the second one and the third one really well.
The first one, it's just, the mad scientist guy.
Mm-hmm, Cortex. Yeah.
Is, he's got a beam that makes animals smart.
Mm-hmm.
So he's creating an army. Crash is a failed experiment.
Oh.
And Crash just wants to save his girlfriend. So that's about it.
Wait, is who's his girlfriend?
She's another bandicoot. They abandon her as a character.
Oh, that sucks.
Which, yeah, it does suck.
Maybe like their relationship didn't work out between Crash 1 and Crash 2.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Hey, there we go. We're making up stories
exactly.
Now about it. But anyway, getting back to our main point of the blank slate mechanism for storytelling is that, yeah, I guess the point is that it really works well in all mediums.
Yeah.
And it works especially well in video games. Mm-hmm. But here we're seeing it, Mad Max, The Matrix, WALL-E. I'm sure there's a dozen movies, probably way more than a dozen movies that we're not talking about right now. If we can have somewhere that has comments, if anybody can or email us, let us know. Cause we would love to like watch your suggestions.
Please do.
And then obviously in literature too. I mean, that's where it all started. This is not really a book.
Yeah. Before movies and video games, all we had was books.
Yeah. This is not really a book focused podcast, but that's something that comic books too. I mean, sure.
Totally.
We could talk about that sometime too, but anyway, we are at, this is a pretty good stopping point. It looks like we've been going for pretty long here. My computer's not telling me the exact time, but it's probably over 30 minutes, I'm guessing. Right. So anyway, we'll wrap it up here. Next time we'll have some other topic.
We'll be brainstorming topics for the next episode.
Yep.
Please tune in. And also thank you for listening.
Yeah, this is John Guest and Jesse Gilbert. See you next time.
See you next time.